Welcome to Florida. What a mighty good state.
That is the voice of New York Times bestselling author and award-winning environmental reporter, Craig Pittman, who is laying the foundation for our upcoming guest on this episode. But before we get there, we start the latest column of yours in the Florida Phoenix, CraigFloridaPhoenix.com. So much about Florida's environmental history, really, that I had no idea of.
People don't know. People just don't know that, you know, we've got these sort of, we've talked before about all the hidden gems here in Florida. Well, there are some hidden stink bombs too. And this is one of them. There's a Superfund site in Pensacola that marks the third biggest relocation of residents in U.S. history. It was so bad they had to move the people out, and just like they did with Love Canal and Times Beach, which are the number one and number two for having to relocate residents. They had to move 400 people out from around this area that became known as Mount Dioxin. And the reason they had to move them is because the EPA itself screwed up the cleanup area in the area there, and they were actually helping to poison the people who lived in the neighborhood. It was just, it's sort of a horrible story every way you look at it. And it's only redeemed by the fact that the people fought back and said, "You're killing us. You have to move us. We can't stay here anymore." What prompted me to write this was that the EPA just announced that, thanks to the infrastructure bill, they finally have enough money to finish the cleanup 20 years later, which is just incredible.
And this is in Pensacola. What does the cleanup stem from? What industry?
Wood treatment. That there was a company there called Escambia Wood Treatment that made power poles and railroad ties, dock pilings. They coated with creosote and PCBs and, you know, other cancer-causing chemicals. Dioxin wound up being in the mix. And they would dispose of their waste just by pouring it into a hole in the ground.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, things in Florida, you pour it in a hole in the ground, it doesn't stay in the ground. It doesn't stay in the hole. It migrates. And the people who owned it, one of the owners was the mayor of Pensacola. And all the managers were white. All the workers were black. And the people who lived in the area, the workers lived near the plant, because the banks made sure that was one of the few neighborhoods where they would loan money to black people to buy houses. And so they were basically poisoning this neighborhood where their own workers lived. And the workers said, you know, "I know it's bad for me, but I need a job," you know, even though it was eating the shoes off their feet in like 3 weeks.
Well, if you're looking for a definition of environmental justice, that's what it means. It means citing these industrial locations. And there's a huge battle for this ongoing in Louisiana around Formosa Plastics and an enormous petrochemical plant. But it's the siting of industry which is known to be hazardous to human health in black and brown neighborhoods. And that's exactly what took place.
Well, and they do that because they if we put it in a rich white neighborhood, they're going to fight.
Yeah.
Put it in a poor black neighborhood, they're less likely to fight, or even if they do fight, they're less likely to get anybody to listen to them. That's the reasoning.
Yeah. So. FloridaPhoenix.com for that story. Another real eye-opener from Craig Pittman. Visit Sarasota sponsors this episode of Welcome to Florida. Be sure you are visiting Visit Sarasota on social media, at Visit Sarasota County on Instagram, at Visit Sarasota on Twitter and Facebook. They just put up a new video from the Ringling to their Instagram account. And don't forget about those Ringling walking garden tours this winter. All the weather has been so perfect. Images up from the Sarasota Jungle Gardens on National Bird Day. More walking tours offered by Sarasota Audubon for the bird watchers. And don't forget Oscar Shearer State Park for bird watching, particularly the Florida Scrub Jay. You've got the celery fields, 400 acres, almost 250 bird species. Visit Sarasota.com. Follow them on social media. Outdoor activities, concerts, arts, culture, dining, shopping. For your next weekend getaway or week-long vacation, visit Sarasota County. Check them out online, visitsarasota.com. Our guest this week, John Capoya, who is a recently retired Tampa University professor. But what we're interested in is his recent 2018 book, Florida Soul, From Ray Charles to Casey and the Sunshine Band. You know John from talking to one of his journalism classes, and of course you're a big music fan yourself, Craig.
Yes, yeah. John is, he's got so many stories about this book, about the research that went into this book, about the interesting background of the people involved. You know, it's, to me, it's kind of intriguing that he went into this book after having written a biography of Gorgeous George, the pro wrestler. So I really want to ask him, how do you go from pro wrestling to soul music, which pro wrestling is kind of, you know, mm-hmm. let's just say it's very fake. Soul music is all about authenticity and raw emotions. And it just, I can't imagine how you get from one of those to the other.
John Capoya, here we go.
John, it's so great to have you on here today. Before we start talking about Florida Soul, I have to ask you about your previous book, which is a biography of Gorgeous George. You told me this great story about tracking down one of the sources for the book at a nudist resort.
So, you know, Gorgeous George was a big celebrity in the 50s and into the 60s in entertainment wrestling, you know, all showmen.
Yeah.
He created this guy you love to hate image, a sort of quasi-effeminate, arrogant persona, and he became a big star. Inspired Muhammad Ali to say things like, I'm the prettiest and I'm the greatest, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. Ali always admitted or complimented him on. He was deceased when I was writing this biography, so I was speaking to his contemporaries, people who wrestled with him or worked with him, as they call it, because it's sort of a, you know, entertainment tag team. And I found this guy in San Diego who had worked with him a lot, named Don Arnold. He was a good guy, lifeguard, clean cut type wrestler. And George was obviously a bad boy. And, you know, they matched them up. He did tell me that later in his career, George, who drank himself to death, that George was drunk in the ring and it made it really tough to work with him. But when I contacted him, he said, well, yeah, we're outside of San Diego a little bit. And my wife will tell you how to get here. So he put her on the phone. I was in New York. And she said, well, we're in this park, this community. And so you drive here, you drive there or whatever, blah, blah, blah. And so I said, OK, great. And then she said, well, so when you come, will you be wearing clothes? And I said, yeah, I wear them all the time. You know. And she said, well, we're nudists, essentially. And she said, we don't like living in the textile world. So she said, we are in a nudist colony, which turned out to be a trailer park. And so we're kind of expecting, you know, that if you come to see us, that you'll conform to our ways. So I said, okay. Yeah. So I rented a trailer. I spent a few days out there. Hmm. And believe me, it was not a sexy thing. at one point, though, we were in the trailer, we're in the kitchen, around the kitchen table, and Don is describing some of his like signature moves, and he tells me about the figure four leg lock. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I don't really, and he goes, well, here, right now. So the next thing I know, I'm lying down naked on this linoleum, this 250-pound naked guy on top of me. And I think, is this how all the great biographers do it? but I tell my students that story and I say, you know, the moral of the story is say yes, don't say no. You never know. You know, that's part of the fun thing about journalism. And it, to the extent that you can, make the people feel comfortable and show them that you're willing to.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think that's what Craig was referring.
Yes. So how do you go from writing about Gorgeous George and pro wrestling to writing about Florida soul artists like Ray Charles? And
well, you know, I mean, the same way I my previous book before Gorgeous George was about yoga. I just followed my passions and my intrigue. In other words, I got into yoga. I realized that very few men were doing it. I thought it was great. So I wrote a book called Real Men Do Yoga. Learned a lot more about yoga by doing the book. I was not interested in pro wrestling at all. Never watched it. Thought it was stupid. I remember my grandparents watching it, though, when we would go visit them. They would have it on the black and white TV. And my father would go, that's fake. Come on. You know. and he was a boxer. And I remember his parents go, no, no, Mike, look at the blood. Look at the, you know, like, so, anyway, I saw this documentary about Muhammad Ali, and he said, Yeah, there was this white guy. I met him in Las Vegas when I was 19. I was Cassius Clay. And I saw him say things like, I'm the prettiest and I'm the greatest. And the crowd went nuts. And he told me afterwards, we worked at the same place. Hey, you could do this. You know, you got a mouth on you. Besides, you're black. People are ready to hate you. You know? So I said, oh, that's interesting. And then I was reading James Brown's memoir, I Feel Good. In it, he says, so I saw the wrestler Gorgeous George on TV and his flamboyant act, and I started wearing robes and capes on stage, just like he did. And he had George was attended to in the ring by a butler character, a valet, named Jeffrey Jeffries. And James Brown's version was he had the Cape Man, a guy who would run out, but James Brown would pretend to collapse on stage and this guy would run out and put the cape on him. So I'm like, wow, how about that? And then the weirdest one of all is I'm reading Bob Dylan's memoir. And obviously he didn't take any showmanship from Gorgeous George.
No.
But it turns out when he was little Bobby Zimmerman in Minnesota, trying to be a musician. Nobody wanted to listen to his band. Let's face it, his voice, he's got a terrible voice, right? I mean, and he was about to give it up. And he said, I could either go work in the iron mines, which is what you do in northern Minnesota, or I was thinking about going to West Point, which I, you know, couldn't believe. But then he says, but I was performing in this armory one day, and in comes Gorgeous George, the wrestler. And he says that he was unbelievably charismatic and that he thought he and George exchanged a look and that George was giving him some kind of vibe such that he said, it inspired me for years to come. I didn't give up being a performer. And I never forgot his charisma and blah, blah, blah. So I'm like, wait a minute, Muhammad Ali, James Brown, Bob Dylan, these are like three of the greatest performers of my lifetime. And they all said they were influenced or inspired by this guy who's like, doesn't even wrestle. Who is this guy? So that was the genesis. And then the same thing happened with Florida Soul. It began to, you know, when I moved down to Florida from New York, I had, you know, I similarly had a series of revelations or things were introduced to me such that I didn't even know Ray Charles was from Florida. You know, he sang Georgia on my mind pretty quickly.
You assumed he was from Georgia, yeah.
And he was born in Georgia, but when he was 6 months old, his mother took him to North Florida where he grew up in a little town called Greenville. And, he went blind there. He went to the St. Augustine School for the Deaf and Blind, and he learned to read music in Braille there, which was very important.
Yeah.
He became a professional in Florida. He wrote his first songs in Florida. He recorded his first songs in Florida, including the St. Pete Florida Blues. And he had his first success in Florida. So, yeah. Okay.
Well, and he did turn our state song into a rock and roll number, right? Swanee River Rock. Oh, way down.
So that was sort of the equivalent of me finding out that Muhammad Ali was inspired by Gorgeous George. So then I read that Sam Moore, you know, Sam and Dave was one of the bands that I grew up with. And, you know, they did Soul Man and Hold On, I'm Coming. Yeah. I Thank You. You know, when I was growing up, I grew up on their music and I loved it. I knew they recorded for Stax Records in Memphis, these big hits. But it turns out Sam Moore is from Overtown, black neighborhood in Miami. That's where he met Dave Prater, who's from Georgia, not from Florida. They formed their duo there in a nightclub called the King of Hearts in Liberty City. And they had their first success there. They did their first recordings there, so much so that they were invited to come and record at Stax Records, et cetera. So I'm like, oh, how about that? So, and then I encountered this urban legend about Tampa, which is that the big hit, probably the biggest song and dance craze of a boomer era is the Twist. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you were alive at that time and you realize like it was, everybody was doing it, young people, older people, black people, white people, they were twisting in the Soviet Union. Jackie and John Kennedy were twisting in the White House. It was on the cover of Life magazine. I mean, it was huge. The huge song was recorded by Chubby Checker,
right?
And in Philadelphia, Dave Clark had him do that. And then Dave Clark had him on his very popular TV show, American Bandstand. And the thing took off. The rest is history, or as I say in the book, twistery. Come to find out, at least in Tampa, they believe that, well, we know that Hank Ballard wrote that song. And yeah. Chubby Checker covered it at Dick Clark. I'm sorry, did I call him Dave Clark? That's the Dave Clark Five. That's somebody else.
Dick Clark. Yeah.
Dick Clark at his behest. And basically, he created Chubby Checker. This guy's name, I forget what it was. And he had him do it, you know, note for note, word for word cover. And then he had the guy on his TV show and it blew up. Hank Ballard had previously released it a year or two before and had a hit on the R&B charts. You know, at the time, the record business and sales were segregated like everything else. There was the R&B charts, in which was the music that was selling to black people by black performers, and then the Hot 100 or the pop chart. Hank Ballard's song only ever penetrated the R&B chart. Mm-hmm. The good news is he did get the songwriting credit. So,
he made some money off of it. Yeah.
All of the success that Chubby Checker had, at least, you know, he did get paid. And so the story was, and on the 50th anniversary of the Twist hitting number one, I wrote a story for the Tampa Bay Times about this idea. And it seems, in fact, that Hank Ballard said he and the Midnighters, his band, were playing Tampa, one of those clubs on Central Avenue, which it was the center of the Black Arts and Entertainment District, the business district in Florida, in Tampa, when it was segregated. And he saw these young, like teenage girls doing this crazy little dance, swiveling their hips on Central Avenue. And he asked them what they were doing. And they said, it's a little thing we made up, but we call it the Twist. So he wrote a song, put some lyrics to it, and he recorded it in Cincinnati. And so I did in some investigation, and it seems very much that it's true, that the Twist came from Tampa. Now, again, this is starting to build up. Like, we've got Ray Charles, Sam and Dave, the Twist, you know. So now I'm looking, you know, those things just came to me. So then I find out that James and Bobby Purify, the other probably most successful and best known soul duo, were from Florida, Pensacola.
My hometown. Yeah.
Okay. So what was their big hit? You remember?
I'm Your Puppet.
Yeah. I'm Your Puppet. very, very different sound, very pop, you know. Mm-hmm. So I interviewed both of them, James and Bobby. James just died. And I interviewed their producer, Papa Don Schroeder.
Oh, yeah.
who put them together. And actually, Bobby Purify wasn't related, and he wasn't even named Bobby Purify, but it was a producer's, it was a publicity thing, and he thought it would be good. So he said, you're Bobby Purify. And the guy said, okay. Yeah. So they had a lot of success. You know, these things just started to build, and I realized in Miami, there was a guy, a producer, who produced a lot of music that I grew up listening to, a guy named Henry Stone, who's since deceased, had TK Records, and he had Betty Wright on his label, who had a cleanup woman. I think she was 17, 18 years old with that. A guy named Lattimore, who lives in Riverview, had a song called Let's Straighten It Out. That was a big hit. You still hear it on Quiet Storm Radio or whatever. And then I found out there's a woman named Linda Lindell, who grew up outside of Gainesville singing in the black church, but she's white. And she had a song that went, what a man, what a man.
What a mighty good man.
What a mighty good man.
Yes.
And that was a big hit. And nobody knew she was white. And she actually, she performed on the otherwise all black Chitlin' circuit with a black band. So I interviewed her. And I interviewed the guy who led the review that she was part of. You know, at this point, I think probably before this sequence was completed, I proposed it to the University Press of Florida. They seemed like the natural publisher, and, you know, they went for it and they issued a contract. It was a labor of love. I spent a long time tracking these people down and driving all over Florida to sit down with them, all the people who are still alive.
Right.
I kind of avoided people who weren't because
they don't talk much.
You know, their interviews tend to be less engaging. But obviously, Ray Charles, there's a lot out there on him. You know, the only person I could not get to who I wanted to very badly and who's alive is Betty Wright. I just could not penetrate her PR apparatus. And I had, Timmy Thomas is another guy who was on that same TK Records and performed and recorded with Betty Wright. And he's like, I'll call Betty. Don't worry. I'll hook it up. Like, didn't happen. I spoke to Betty Wright's sister and I didn't get to talk to her. So, and then she recently passed also.
She died recently. Yeah. It was a shame.
Super, super talented. And she was a vocal coach and a minister. And, you know, I really wanted to talk to her. But, So, and it was actually a great way of me kind of getting to know Florida more and better, because I didn't go to the tourist places. I went to where like X person lived, you know. And the other fun part about it is my wife, who's a photographer, although not really a journalist photographer, but she came along and she took contemporary portraits of the people who survived. So those are in the book. So, you know, it was very satisfying. There was no financial payoff with that. That's book. It turns out, I think that even a lot of people from Florida did not realize that they are, in fact, a soul capital of this country.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think people don't think of these groups and think, oh, that's Florida. That's Florida producing all these soul groups. They assign it to Memphis or Atlanta or, you know, New York, someplace like that.
Motown. Well, I think Motown is kind of a clue. Also, yeah, New Orleans, great R&B town.
Oh, yeah.
I think a lot of those places that we mentioned, they've got like a distinctive sound. Certainly Motown did. In Memphis, there was a Stax sound and then later a High Records sound, Al Green's label.
Oh, yeah.
New Orleans sounds, you know, New Orleansy with the funky meter that they use. And Florida, you know, being so big and so diverse, I don't think, well, there is no Florida soul sound. And I think maybe that's one reason. Like the I'm Your Puppet that you mentioned, Craig, that sounds nothing like I'm a soul man, you know.
Sure.
In Miami, some of the soul music has some Latin
influence
flavor.
Too. Mm-hmm.
Also some Caribbean influence down there. In fact, I interviewed Harry Wayne Casey.
Mm-hmm.
AKA KC of the Sunshine Band. Mm-hmm. And he told me that originally the name of the band was KC and the Sunshine Junkanoo Band. Junkanoo is a Bahamian festival, and there's a big Bahamian population in Miami. When they have this festival and parades, there's a music that they play, which involves a lot of horns, a lot of whistles, a lot of percussion. And initially, they were trying to recreate that sound and become sort of an ersatz Junkanoo band. So I think the disparity, or you could look at it as the wealth of different sounds, is a great thing for us as listeners. And it adds up to a great cultural heritage. But I think it's too dispersed for people to say, that's Florida soul. Yeah.
That's interesting you mentioned that, because that was going to be my question. You know, was there some sort of network or infrastructure that allowed these people to rise to the top? And it doesn't really seem that way. You know, you got Pensacola, Tampa, Miami. Those are hundreds of miles apart. So this seems more like brilliantly talented individuals overcoming all of the odds to somehow make it, despite there not being any real groundwork in Florida to prop them up upon.
Well, the exception is this, like a lot of things in Florida, the locus is Miami. And this guy, Henry Stone, you know, was behind a lot of the music. KC recorded for him. KC was a clerk in his record thing. Like he put records in packages when people ordered them for Henry. And then he said, well, can I use the studio after hours and try to fool around? And he's like, yeah, go ahead. Well, you know, that was kind of the most influential. But other than that, yeah, it has no connection to people all over the, you know.
Yeah. Well, who recorded for Henry Stone? Was Betty Wright another one who recorded for him?
Yes.
Yeah.
Betty Wright, KC, Lattimore, Timmy Thomas. Mm-hmm. A lot of the people that are in my book, they either came from there or they gravitated there because he was a distributor for Atlantic. So he had a connection. In fact, he was part of the way that Sam and Dave got to Stax, because they were an Atlantic artist and they recorded at Stax for them. So, you know, Henry Stone was a very influential guy. Like a lot of producers, some of the artists feel that he took advantage of them. You know, that's kind of a perennial in the music business. I don't know, you know, obviously I don't know the truth or not of that.
Yeah, you're a writer, not an accountant.
and you know, some other people swear by him. And he, I must say, he was great with me. So the book is sort of constructed, it goes chronologically, beginning with Ray Charles in the mid-1940s, and then it ends with KC and the Sunshine Band in the late 70s. So I sort of align that each different person or group is a chapter, like each singer, each musician.
Another reminder that this week's episode of Welcome to Florida is brought to you by Visit Sarasota and Visit Sarasota County. Hey, congratulations go out to Siesta Key, which has just been ranked number one by the readers of TravelAwaits.com as the best beach in the United States. Reading from the website, our readers voted Siesta Key as the best beach in the U.S. in TravelAwaits 2021 Best of Travel Awards. Our writers love it too. That's probably because in addition to powdery white sand beaches made of quartz, this Gulfside barrier island offers everything from kayaking and boating to fine dining and day drinking. Spend the day shelling, then savor succulent crab as you watch the stellar sunset. Siesta Key ranked number one best beach in the U.S. by TravelAwaits online. No argument here.
Was it hard for you to find Linda Lindell? Because I know she kind of went into hiding after her big hit.
Yes, it was. I found a friend who vouched for me, a guy who performed with her and who was actually very helpful, a guy named Charles Stedham, who goes by Charlie Blade. And he is from Gainesville. And he worked with Linda in this on the circuit. Yeah, she, you know, as she told me and I describe in my book, she just had her biggest success at Stax recording What a Man. And it was produced by a guy named Dave Crawford from Jacksonville, who did a lot of work at Atlantic. He also was a producer for Jackie Moore, who did a song called Precious Precious. She's from Jacksonville. Right after that song came out, she was supposed to go back to Stax and record more. And the way she told me is then Dr. King was assassinated in Memphis. Racial things got very fraught and very heated. And she was told they didn't need any white people around at Stax. Thank you very much.
Well, did she not get some threats from the Klan, too, for being a white singer?
Yes, she was. Well, also, when they were on the road, they traveled throughout the South on this chitlin' circuit. And, you know, law enforcement and other officialdom did not like to see this white lady traveling with all these black guys. You know, the way Charlie Blade told me, they said, well, look, a black band, they could understand. A white band, they could understand. A white lady with a black man, you know. And so at one point, she told me she bought an Afro wig.
Oh, my God.
And put it up. So she would wear it in the car, in the station wagon, whatever. So people would just look and go, or a bunch of black guys, or, you know, people. Kind of got it from both sides. There was the clannish side that, like, we don't like you hanging around with these black guys. And then after Dr. King was killed, you know, we don't necessarily want to be around too many white people right now either. Right. So she basically had, you know, retired, you know.
Wow. Became this one hit wonder, but then it resurfaced because it got re-recorded, right?
Yes. It was a combination of En Vogue and Salt and Pepa, I think.
Yes.
They all collaborated on What a Man, What a Man, What a Mighty Good Man. One thing about that song also that's kind of typical of soul music and a fair amount of Florida soul music is Dave Crawford, who supposedly wrote it, although Linda says she wrote it, you know, co-wrote it with him. A lot of it was apparently improvised, and it's not much to the lyrics, really, you know, beside that chorus, which is great.
Yeah.
It was originally, that song is about Jesus. It was a church song that Dave Crawford transposed into a secular song. And for example, that happened a lot. Like Ray Charles' song, I Got a Woman, Way Across Town, that was I Got a Savior, right? So when this started happening, a lot of church folks were not happy with Ray Charles and other soul musicians because they were taking the sacred and making it the profane. You know? In Ray Charles' case, they had to get over it because he was a genius. Yeah.
You mentioned a couple of times the Chitlin Circuit. Explain what that is.
It's a name that was used to describe, again, during the time of segregation. There was always, you know, there was a black part of town in which the black business and entertainment district was and black people lived. And there were clubs there. And so black performers would go from one black part of one town to another throughout the South. And in Florida, you know, you would say, let's say, go Pensacola, Jacksonville, Orlando, Tampa, St. Pete. I don't know, whatever's between there and Miami. And then this guy, Lavelle Kama, with whom Linda Lindell won, they went all into Texas and whatever. So it was the black entertainment venues where black performers perform for black customers, except for Linda Lindell. And so the Chitlin references because that's soul food. I also found out, you know, when I was doing this research, like the Chitlin Circuit usually is thought of as kind of funky dives. And certainly out in the country, you know, there's these juke joints. And yeah. I know performers told me, like, well, you'd be out there and like there'd be a lot of fights. And also, like, you could see through the floorboards, the dirt below, you know. Because for one thing, there's a lot of agricultural workers in Florida then and now. And, you know, they would go to these places. Mm-hmm. But I learned this from Professor Gary Mormino, who's a great Florida historian.
Oh, yes.
That after World War II, Florida was the most urbanized state in the South. And so in addition to these funkier juke joints, there were pretty elegant black clubs in the big cities where people would dress up and go there. And they would pay more to hear like a big band that would travel in, like, you know, Cab Calloway or what have you. And I saw some pictures some of which I use in my book. And this one place with a huge balcony around it. And there's another one from an article in Crisis, which is the magazine of the NAACP. And they said they called this place, I believe in Jacksonville, the finest dance palace owned by a Negro in the whole country. The dance floor holds 2,000 people.
Wow.
You know, it may have been an exaggeration, but so partly why also people thrived in Florida and is that there were these two circuits in a sense. There was what we usually think of as the funky Chitlin Circuit and then the more elegant, upscale.
More sophisticated, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you listen to the music while you were writing? Did that help you along while you were writing?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I some of it I hadn't listened to in some time, you know. To me, it holds up. I suppose every generation thinks that their music was, you know, classic. But I say in my introduction to the book, you know, I was watching ESPN one night and waiting for Monday Night Football to come on. And they cut away to a commercial and they played Sam and Dave, Hold On, I'm Coming. And I thought, you know what? That song is 50 years old, you know? You know, you cannot go to a wedding or a bar mitzvah without hearing a KC and the Sunshine Band song or three. And I listen also to Betty Wright, the cleanup woman. I'm like, you know what? Maybe that's the best Florida soul song of all. And Ray Charles is like, you know, the guy's a genius. You know, he did perform also with a country western band in Florida.
Yes.
The only black guy and certainly the only blind black guy in that band. I think they were called the Playboys. And he later went on to record two albums of country songs. And They were fantastic. So especially before I was about to go interview someone, I would listen to their music, you know, like the Purifiers or what have you. And yeah, it really brought it all back to me.
Was there any of it that you heard, you were hearing for the first time, you'd never heard before, and you went, wow, that's, how did that not penetrate my consciousness before now?
I mean, I'm sure there were, because like I said, when I came down here, I didn't know any of these people from Florida. In my defense, I would say, like, you know, when you're listening to the AM radio in your car, as we used to do, and they play The Cleanup Woman by Betty Wright, they don't say, you know, she's from Miami. You know,
well, maybe they should. I didn't know the Cornelius Brothers and Sister Rose were from Florida, for instance. Yeah. That was brand new to me.
Yes, yeah. And, you know, there some people told me, you know, oh, you should have written about them. You should have included them. And Greg, you probably get this kind of thing when you have your book.
Oh, yeah. So,
you
know,
it comes up with what you did wrong. And, you know, I just try to be nice and go, look, you can't put everything in a book. When would you stop? You know, or,
yeah.
Or, you know what? I didn't know that. I'm sorry. You know, so when you write your book, you'll do it better.
Yeah, that's right.
You talk about finding a stopping point for the book, and you chose that with the 70s and Casey and the Sunshine Band. Yeah. What did this movement morph into, evolve into? If I had to guess, maybe the Miami hip hop scene with, you know, Two Live Crew and the bass scene, that type of deal in the 80s?
Huh? Yeah, I think I think there maybe it was the disco era in between. And some people's consider Casey and the Sunshine Band disco, although he rejects that. And then actually the Two Live Crew and some of those people, they were recorded by Henry Stone too. Wow. So he had his hand in a lot of things. But yeah, that was the bass and that kind of stuff coming out of Miami. You know, disco really did a lot of harm to the soul business and soul performers. Some of them tried to go disco, you know, with greater or lesser success. Johnny Taylor had a successful song called Disco Lady, but, you know, not his best work. And then I think, it moved into hip hop. Yeah. For all I know, there's a Florida hip hop book to be written, but it's not going to.
There you go. with Pitbull and all the rest.
Yeah. Well, you know, some people have suggested, like, well, Florida jazz, you know, like the Cannonball Adderley and his brother, Nat Adderley, this person, that person. And I'm like, ugh.
When did you move to Florida?
2009, I think.
What were your perceptions of the state before living here?
I didn't have too many perceptions. I had only been to Miami. Like, I never went to Disney World or whatever. And I visited the University of Tampa a couple of times, which is where I ended up being a professor. You know, I guess I read about the Everglades. So, I mean, it was a pretty ill thought out move, to be honest. And you can ask my wife if you don't believe me. Yeah. But I had, I think, very little sense of it. I really wanted to get a professor's job so I could have time to write. And ultimately, you know, you get tenure and you have some security, you know, which I did. So I actually, I just retired from there. It worked, you know, it worked out pretty good. I mean, if I hadn't come here, you know, I mean, I would have thought of something else. But I also got involved in a project. You know, my wife came down and she started a project in which she photographed like the ruins or the remains of Native American mounds and earthworks and things like that remain. And many are still here.
Yes.
And she had photographed some of them before in other southern states. And so we did a project together. And again, we drove around the state to all these places. So she took black and white landscape pictures. And, you know, they're not what they were. So, you know, I mean, it's very... They're very kind of evocative. And I researched the people who made them and what they were about and what, you know, we did an art installation that we collaborated on in which she printed out her pictures like really big on fabric, like 6 foot by 6 foot pieces of fabric that hung in the museum. And then I wrote little vignettes about each of these pictures and we projected them on the walls of the it was in the Appleton Museum in Ocala, and we showed it at the Morian Art Institute in St. Petersburg. So that was to say that we got something else out of being in Florida, too, that we would not have gotten, you know, elsewhere.
John Capuia, Florida Soul, from Ray Charles to Casey and the Sunshine Band. There's a link down in the show notes to purchase the book. Thank you so much for your time today.
This has been great. Thanks again.
My pleasure. Okay, thanks, guys.
What a guest. What a mighty good guest.
You're a huge music guy, Craig. You're always sharing your favorite artists and songs on your social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Craig Times. Where does soul and the artists we've been talking about land in your greatest hits playlist? Oh,
well, I love it. And you know, every Friday I post a Funky Friday clip. But I really love having that connection with James and Bobby Purify and with Papa Don Schroeder, who was a DJ in Pensacola when I was growing up. I didn't realize he'd been a record producer. And then they didn't just do I'm Your Puppet. They also did a version of Shake a Tail Feather, which is a lot of fun as well. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I kind of like that better.
I had no idea the astonishingly famous What a Man, What a Man, What a Man was a cover. You know, I mean, I am familiar with the contemporary version of that you hear everywhere still to this day. I had no idea there was a Florida connection to that. And that's why we do the podcast in large measure to raise awareness.
We're trying to inform people. So let me tell you, this isn't strictly soul. This is more of a rock and roll thing. But one of the more famous Florida music stories, and people don't realize it's from Florida, is when the song Louie Louie came out, done by the Kingsmen, there was a rumor that went around that it was actually that all the lyrics were absolutely filthy. And so the FBI investigated.
Oh, boy.
And the person who got the FBI to investigate was a Sarasota educator. We don't know his name. They've redacted that out of the report. But if you go on the FBI website, they actually have posted the files of their investigation into it, in which they finally concluded that it was incomprehensible at any speed.
So. This week's episode of Welcome to Florida brought to you by Visit Sarasota. And if this is the kind of music you are interested in, check out the website for the Van Wetzel Performing Arts Center. This winter, there will be a Tina Turner tribute act, an Aretha Franklin tribute act, and Gladys Knight, not a tribute act, the actual performer Gladys Knight.
Yes.
Will be there at the Van Wetzel.
She might even bring a pip or two.
Check it out online again, Van Wetzel Performing Arts Center in Sarasota. I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well, and be sure to be following Visit Sarasota on social media, at Visit Sarasota County on Instagram, at Visit Sarasota on Twitter and Facebook. One other episode from the archive specifically about music, and that was our Southern Rock episode, focused more on the Jacksonville area and the Lynyrd Skynyrd, Marshall Tucker, those kind of bands. So if you are interested in this sort of thing, get back through the Welcome to Florida archives.
And welcome to Florida.